Julie, Herb Hauptmann was not involved, I don't think, in any of the electron diffraction work. People who were, it was John Ainsworth who had worked with us in the early days.
Yeah, that's how this question got going.
Yes.
John Ainsworth.
And then David Swick was here for quite a number of years.
A little later.
Yes, but he was here doing the electron diffraction.
What was this guy's name? He was a draftsman who drew up the plans for us.
Yes, but he didn't do the experiment.
He was not an experimental scientist.
He was a draftsman.
He was the draftsman. Mm-hmm. Last name was Huber, I could find
Daniel.
Out. Daniel Huber.
Mm-hmm.
But so far as scientific people at first, I guess John.
John Ainsworth was the one.
Yeah. What was his background?
Well, he was a physicist. He didn't quite make it to the PhD.
Did you know Hauptmann at City College?
Not really. Mm-hmm. When I saw him, I remembered his face. Mm-hmm. He may have been in some of my classes that people just take generally, English or Science Survey or something or so.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know him well there at all.
I just wonder if your paths had crossed previous to NRO.
No.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't an unfamiliar figure, but I don't know that we ever had any conversations together.
It's after 12 o'clock. I don't know. We didn't state what your schedules were at the beginning. And do you have commitments now? That what is your pleasure?
Should we go to 12:30 or something?
All right.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't have any commitments. My back was just beginning to get a little stiff from sitting here.
We'll cut it off at 12:30. Okay. 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Mm-hmm. How did you divide up the work? On your research?
It just falls naturally into place. People do what they like to do and what they best do.
Well, most of mine was from the experimental part, working in the laboratory. Most of his was pencil and paper.
It's very important to point out that the crystal structure problem is one in which there's a very big gap between the theoretical work and the experimental application. In fact, this comes into an area which is largely overlooked in science. I have written some articles about this. Something that I and some other people call bridging, which is an obvious term. And a simple statement of what bridging is to manipulate and accommodate the mathematics so that it can be applied to experimental data, and at the same time to manipulate the experimental data in such a way that it becomes applicable to the existing theory. This required a great deal of work so far as the mathematics is concerned. What I mean by that is that there are any numbers of ways of writing down the mathematics which states the answer in terms of the measurements, but you can't get anywhere with it. That kind of mathematics is not amenable to any of the analytical techniques or the size of computing machines that exist in this world. And so you have to use it in such a form and in such a way that progress can be made. On the other hand, data always comes in a form that is not quite what you want. And so you have to do many things to it and do it carefully to get it into the form in which you want it. As a matter of fact, one of the things that's important to do is the same thing that we were doing with the gas diffraction, to manipulate the data in such a way that it acts as if it had come from point atoms instead of atoms that have electron distributions around them. That's just one small point. And then the math is still so complicated that you have to proceed through it in probability ways.
If I may interject a point before you go on.
Yes.
Data is always limited. And the mathematics assumes that there's infinite data.
Well, that's another one of its dear little aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we found was practical was to go through this in a stepwise procedure, making use of probability meshes, and finding out just how to tiptoe through that and not get off on paths that lead you to oblivion was a very, very difficult thing to do. Isabella made very, very important contributions to the practical aspects and to the bridging. This has been totally lost on people who are not familiar with her work, because the award went to Herb and me. But it's very, very well known amongst the colleagues, the contributions that she's made to this field. I just wanted that to be in the record.
Absolutely. That first paper, if I'm correct, that first paper with Hauptmann was 53. Is that it?
No.
Or had you had
no. Yes, there were others. This is what happens in newspapers. The first paper that really established everything was written in 1950.
Published in 1950.
Sorry about that. The results, you can see how feverishly we looked in those days. The results were actually announced at a meeting early in 49. We already knew all the mathematics that was basic to this field. Now, its aspect had to be developed, and it took about 6 more years to do that. The probabilistic aspects had to be developed. We had to learn which of the infinitely many formulas that we had in there were the ones to use and how to relate them to the probability theory, etc. But the key paper was one that was published in 1915, as I say, announced at a meeting. Fortunately,
what meeting?
For the record, this was a meeting of the Crystallographic Society of America. I think I still have the abstract from there. They published the abstract to their meeting in their own journal. It might have been the Mineralogical Society of America, so let me make absolutely sure. There was no American Crystallographic Association in those days. But I have the publication and a copy from it. I don't have the publication, but I have a copy from it. And it very clearly states what the results of this was. This was in, I believe, April of 1949. We probably started to do that at the end of 48. Same time. That was really the basic papers, and everything was a development from. The 53 thing was a monograph, and that was an attempt to develop the probability measures that were associated with the formulas that already came from this paper. See, this paper was a statement of what happens if you take advantage of this non-negativity criterion. He used something called Fourier series to represent the electron density in a crystal. And this was a paper that spelled out the conditions for a non-negative Fourier series. And the conditions were in the form of inequalities, not equalities, but inequalities. But these inequalities also had probabilistic characteristics that made them useful for complicated structures. Oh, that, well, that's the 1950 paper, yeah. But somewhere I have a little copy of the abstract.
I couldn't find that at the moment.
No, I don't think it's filed. I have it in the folder. Mm-hmm. I know what to look for. Maybe I can get it for you before you leave, because I think I can find a copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we already knew what to do with this. But you don't know practical aspects, because you have to not only develop the mathematics into a form where it becomes eminently useful, but you also have to bridge the gap to what you get from an experiment and then how you use it in the analytical procedures.
So the initial basic work was done in a two-year period between 46 and 48?
Yeah, actually everything was downhill after that. Oh, yeah, we saw through an awful lot in those 2 years.
Mm-hmm. How did your colleagues react to the initial paper? Were there any response at all?
Oh, there was response. it was one of the most entertaining types of meetings people told me that they ever went to. Most people were intelligently cautious. There were those who felt as if they were really being treated to pie in the sky. And there were a few who developed hostility. And those were the ones who were most outspoken at the meetings. There was good reason to think that what we were telling them was untrue. What you had to get out of this mathematics were phases. And every physicist knows that you never get in an experiment, or at least not an ordinary experiment, phase information from measuring diffraction patterns, that all you do is get certain intensities. Actually, the intensities are associated with how high an X-ray wave oscillates as it goes along its wavy path. The phase, however, has something to do with at one part of the what part of the oscillation the beam is at as it gets scattered away from the surface. And that just disappears. All you really do is get something which is an intensity that's proportional to the square of the amplitude, this highest point of the oscillation in the wave. And so you don't have information. And here are some crazy people telling us that they can find out what the phases are by looking at the amplitudes. You know, that's insane. So the physics background made them just absolutely incredulous. The reason why you can actually do this, though, is because you can set this problem up in terms of algebraic equations in which it's perfectly obvious that you have more information than the unknowns, and among the unknowns are the phases. So it's defined in there. But it isn't obvious. It's very subtly contained in the intensity information.
Well, in actual fact, this just was not applied by any of the experimental X-ray people. And so a number of years later, Jerome decided that I should collect some X-ray data.
Well, we developed it in the first half of the 50s, and Isabella started collecting data in the second half. And there were some few labs who were, very few, who were doing a few things. But they were only very special type of crystals. Those were called the center of symmetry. And the intensities that would come from crystals that would not have a center of symmetry would be completely out of reach. And it was her work during the 60s with these complicated non-centrosymmetric crystals that really established it. And later on, at the end of the 60s, people really took up on this. But for the most part, this lab was always at the forefront of the development, and the particular hard structures were really done for. So there was a first it was impossible, and then it wasn't impossible in principle, but it would be impossible in practice, and that's about the way it stood. It behooved us to show people that it could be done practically. I didn't mind that. I think that they had legitimate reason to be doubtful about the practicality. I was myself. But there was no question about the principle, and that's what all this excitement was about. So it was not greeted with unbridled enthusiasm. But there was another thing about NRL. They knew that we weren't given to frivolous activities, and so we didn't have problems with them because this work was not well accepted. In fact, we continued to be encouraged. That was good. I think if I were trying to get tenure in the university, I would have had some real troubles, especially if they asked the opinion of peers. That insane character.
Oh, it appeared in print. We have a number of articles to that effect.
Really? They
Oh, yeah. But being attacked in print has very interesting consequences. I had no reputation in crystallography, and what was being attacked was this 1953 monograph that was established the probability characteristics very well of the mathematics that we were working with. And one of the more hostile colleagues wrote a book review for CNE News that just said from one end to the other that this is damn foolishness. Since I had no reputation in crystallography, I was never asked to review papers for publication. As soon as that review came out and they spelled my name correctly, I began to get papers to be reviewed for publication. So the notoriety had an immediate payoff. I now had a reputation as a crystallographer. This is true.
I don't know. Do you think that this might be a point to break? Well, I'd like to thank you again very much for your time and energies this morning and sharing more of your career with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No, you're quite welcome.